Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
There are stories hidden beneath the surface of the quietest places.
Mm-hmm.
Places that, you know, they promise peace and solitude, but
right.
they deliver only oblivion.
Right.
In Galveston, Texas, back in the late 1920s, the ocean offered cool air and quiet water.
Mm.
But for dozens of people who were just looking for a brief escape, that tranquility, it offered only a final deadly farewell.
A permanent one.
Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Yeah.
Our mission today is to take the source materials you've given us and do a deep, and I have to say, a deeply unsettling dive into a single chilling narrative.
It really is.
The true crime story of Edgar M. Roe, a man who was eventually branded the Midnight Mariner.
A fitting name.
We are going to chart the astonishingly efficient, very rapid rise and the sudden, terrifying end of a business that wasn't a business at all. Not really.
No, it was a mechanism, a machine.
It was a meticulously disguised mechanism designed for one thing and one thing only, the erasure of human life.
And to really get how this could even happen, you have to set the stage. We're in the late 1920s, heading into the early 1930s.
Right. What was Galveston like then?
It was a place of, well, constant motion, high commerce, intense mobility. It's a huge port, a growing tourist spot. And its whole economy runs on people who aren't from there.
Transient people.
Exactly. Yeah. Visitors, sailors, seasonal dock workers, this constant turn. It creates this built-in anonymity for the whole population.
A crowd to get lost in.
A perfect crowd to get lost in. And what's really crucial here is the idea of localized oversight, or really the lack of it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, a major crime, something big that might draw federal attention, but small localized criminal activity, especially when it's centered on the water, where accidents are, you know, just a part of life that can go completely unnoticed.
By both local police and the feds.
Completely. The sheer number of people coming and going basically created a statistical vacuum, a blind spot.
A blind spot that a very specific kind of predator can step into.
And exploit perfectly. The sources are clear on this. Roe didn't need some complex criminal ring. He just used the natural danger of the ocean and the systemic lack of oversight to hide what he was doing.
It's proof that sometimes the most simple, the most mundane operations are the ones that mask the darkest secrets.
Absolutely.
That context is, well, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Because it's not just a story about one killer. It's a story about a system.
Mm-hmm.
A system that had these gaps that allowed him to operate.
Yeah, a system with blind spots.
Okay, so let's unpack this. We're going to start by looking at the public-facing business that Roe set up in 1928. It's all very benign.
On the surface.
Then we'll track the escalating human toll over those 3 years when nobody was watching. And then we'll get to that critical moment, 1932.
The turning point.
The moment when the authorities finally managed to close the trap on Edgar M. Roe. This whole story is just a profound lesson in how easily systemic gaps can be exploited by one person with cold-blooded intent.
Mm.
The story of the Midnight Mariner starts, ironically enough, not in the shadows, but in the bright light of a public business license.
Mm. Right. It's all above board.
It's 1928. Edgar M. Roe sets up shop in Galveston, Texas. And he doesn't open a speakeasy or some shady gambling den.
No, nothing like that.
According to the source material, he ran a small sightseeing business. Just a single boat offering nighttime tours along the coast.
And it is so vital to stress how low profile this whole venture was. This wasn't a big ferry service or, you know, a deep sea fishing charter.
Right.
It was one boat making short trips. After the sun went down, for all anyone knew, he was just a completely unremarkable part of the Galveston Harbor community.
Just another guy making a living on the water.
And that anonymity was his first, and I would argue his most effective, layer of defense.
We really have to emphasize just how benign it must have looked to everyone. It wasn't marketed as some risky, exciting adventure.
Not at all.
He wasn't promising, you know, a pirate treasure hunt or a high-speed chase. It was just a short, quiet cruise. And that non-threatening brand became the very foundation of his ability to murder at scale.
Absolutely. And we really need to dig into the specific language used to sell these trips. Because, the genius of the whole operation was in its efficiency and the very simple promises it made.
Okay.
The sources, they point to four key marketing points. They're all about comfort and convenience. But when you look closer, they were the four pillars holding up this deadly mechanism.
So what were they?
Okay, so first, the promise of quiet water. This immediately suggests a calm, predictable trip. It minimizes any idea of maritime danger.
No rough seas, nothing to worry about.
Exactly. Second was cool air. Now, you have to think, this is the Texas summer. It's oppressive. The idea of cool air off the water is a huge draw. It's physical relief.
It's not just a luxury. It's a necessity almost.
It is. And third, short rides. This implies it's efficient, it's convenient. You get the nice experience without a huge time commitment.
So those three things together paint a picture of something relaxing, almost therapeutic.
And completely non-threatening.
But you said there was a fourth point.
Yeah.
And this one, as you pointed out earlier, this is the critical one. This is the selection mechanism.
This is the one. The sources say these tours were meant for tourists traveling alone.
Wow.
That single detail, it just flips the entire script.
So is this, like, explicitly marketed? Did he have a sign that said solitary travelers only? Or was it more subtle?
It seems to have been more of a cultivation. Maybe some subtle marketing, but definitely an operational focus. You have to think about the transient life in Galveston at the time.
Right, the dock workers, the sailors.
All of those people. Travelers alone were abundant, and they were looking for simple, low-commitment entertainment. A short boat ride is perfect.
So it's this idea of a false front.
Exactly. We sometimes call it the Aladdin dynamic. The treasure, this quiet, pleasant little tour, was actually the bait for the trap.
So the whole business wasn't designed for sightseeing.
No.
It was designed to maximize the ease of disappearance for a very specific type of customer.
Mm.
Someone with no immediate safety net.
Precisely. A tourist traveling alone, they don't have local connections, their schedule's often loose if they go missing.
Who's going to notice right away?
Nobody. Their absence might not be noticed for days, maybe weeks. Until a relative way back home starts to worry and raises an alarm.
And by the time that missing person report filters all the way down through the bureaucracy and lands in Galveston.
It's a cold case. The death would be so easily categorized as just another accidental drowning, which was tragically common.
So the business model was optimized for anonymity and efficiency of disposal, all built on the isolation of his clients.
That's it, exactly.
This brings up a big question about motive. The sources don't spell it out, but we can kind of infer it from the design.
We say we can.
If he was targeting these solitary travelers, was there a profit motive? Was he robbing them, or was this purely about the act of killing itself?
Well, with serial crime, the motivation often involves, you know, control or compulsion. But the sources do suggest the victims included dock workers and simple travelers, not necessarily wealthy people.
It's probably not carrying a lot of cash.
Right. Robbery might have been a secondary benefit, a little bonus. But the consistency of the method, the boat trip itself, that suggests the main motive was the process. The process of selecting and erasing the victim.
The financial gain from robbing a dock worker wouldn't justify the risk of running this whole operation.
I don't think so. Which means the business was the vehicle for his compulsion. It wasn't an engine for a financial scheme. And that's a terrifying thought. The very relaxation and solitude his victims were seeking was exactly what made them the perfect targets.
He was capitalizing on their isolation. On their desire for just a brief, pleasant moment alone, and he was turning that intimacy into a death sentence.
And because the whole service was so low-key, so unremarkable, no one, not the other boat owners, not the local police, had any reason to look closely at his books or his comings and goings.
That inertia.
It allowed his deadly machine to get up to full speed.
And as you said, for a while, everything seemed fine. Roe was just a man running a small boat. But now we get into the critical time window.
1929 to 1931.
Exactly. This three-year period is where the dark pattern really starts to emerge, where the human cost becomes, you know, statistically impossible to ignore, even if the authorities weren't connecting the dots just yet.
It suggests an escalation. Once Roe figured out his method worked, that the quiet tour was this perfect, impenetrable cover.
He scaled up.
He realized the system's blind spot was huge. His confidence must have grown, leading to more frequent trips, and as a result, a sharp, undeniable increase in missing person reports right there along the Galveston shoreline.
Let's talk about the profile of the missing. The sources list them, and it's not just tourists.
No, it's broader. It was dock workers, travelers, men last seen near the harbor at night.
These are the classic transient residents we were talking about. People with few local contacts, whose disappearance could just so easily be blamed on the hazardous life of a port city.
And this is where that institutional inertia becomes his greatest ally. You have to put yourself in the mindset of the police in 1930.
No.
A dock worker goes missing near the water. What are your first assumptions? They're totally rational.
Drank too much, slipped and fell in.
Right. Maybe there was a storm, a rogue wave, maybe he got into a fight on the docks. The police, who were dealing with countless other routine incidents, they just blamed alcohol, storms, or simple accidents at sea.
They had a ready-made, non-criminal explanation for almost every single disappearance.
They did. And this is a classic systemic challenge you see in so many historical serial crime cases. The environment itself, the constant acknowledged danger of the vast Gulf of Mexico, was the killer's greatest accomplice.
It let law enforcement categorize dozens of separate incidents using these common, non-sinister explanations.
Mm-hmm.
So if the police have, say, 20 missing persons cases over a year, and the port is massive,
right,
and 10 of those people were last seen near the water, it's just so much easier and more efficient to mark them down as presumed drowning than to open a massive, complex criminal investigation for each one.
You're solving the case by categorization. It's exactly that. And it relates to this idea that institutional records can sometimes freeze while lives keep moving.
Like a great phrase.
The official records classified these as accidents or just unresolved cases. And that prevented any further cross-referencing. It prevented a criminal investigation. And that system, that categorization, it basically gave Roe 3 years of completely uninterrupted operation.
So to change that assumption, the police would have needed something huge.
Something overwhelming. A piece of forensic evidence, a body that washed up with clear signs of foul play, or, critically, a deviation from the pattern that they could actually see.
But the sheer number of cases, which statistically had to be an anomaly, it was just absorbed by this perception of Galveston as a busy, sometimes dangerous port town.
That's the power of what you could call statistical fog. The ocean is vast. 100 people going missing over 3 years. Yes, that seems high.
Very high.
But when you spread that across the massive amount of transient traffic passing through a major port, it starts to look like an acceptable loss rate if you believe the cause is environmental.
If you believe it's just the sea taking its due.
Exactly. Roe knew that the bigger the sea, the harder it is to find a single drop of evidence. And he relied on that official inertia. He understood that volume was the best camouflage.
So for 3 years, the missing person reports were just a predictable, manageable cost of his deadly business. And nobody was connecting the one single consistent variable.
His boat, operating after dark.
It just paints this terrifying picture of a man operating in plain sight, completely covered by the assumptions that society makes about maritime accidents and transient people.
The police were looking for something loud and violent.
Not something quiet and sketchy.
Yeah, exactly. Not a 9 o'clock appointment with death.
But that impunity, it couldn't last forever. It eventually hit a wall. And that wall wasn't built out of forensics, but out of simple, methodical arithmetic.
I love that. It's so true.
The story takes this crucial turn when a different agency gets involved. The Coast Guard Patrol.
Right. And their focus is totally different from the police.
They're not looking for criminals. They're focused on maritime safety, on licensing, on regulations. And they noticed something strange.
And an inconsistency.
An inconsistency that was just too mathematical to ignore.
And this is the perfect example of how an external set of eyes, an external oversight body, can reveal patterns that are invisible to the local authorities.
Because they're looking at different data.
They're looking at different data with a different goal. The Coast Guard is fundamentally worried about compliance, passenger limits, manifest accuracy, that sort of thing. And what they noticed was the one key quantifiable detail.
A headcount.
The headcount. Roe's boat was repeatedly, consistently coming back to shore with fewer passengers than it left with.
It's incredible that the answer was just subtraction.
Huh, right.
Someone finally started counting heads on the way in and counting heads on the way out, and the numbers just did not balance. Not once, but over and over again.
And for any other business, you might chalk it up to a miscount once or twice. But Roe's discrepancy was consistent.
Which suggested a process.
It indicated a mechanical, deliberate process of passenger reduction. And that forced the authorities to finally move beyond the assumption of accidental loss.
The question completely changed.
Completely. It went from, did they fall in, to where did they go?
And that anomaly, that simple math problem, it signaled that the problem wasn't the weather. It wasn't the waves. It was the operation itself.
Which is when Roe was finally forced to explain this mathematical imbalance. He was questioned by the Coast Guard.
And his alibi, his excuse, I mean.
Mm.
On paper, it sounds sort of plausible.
Ish.
Yeah.
He claimed that his customers often asked to be dropped off early.
And you know, in a busy port during the day, that might actually fly.
Sure, people get seasick, they change their minds.
They spot a friend on another dock. There are possibilities, but, and this is the key, you have to apply the critical localized context of Galveston at night in the early 1930s.
What's the context?
The analysis in the sources points out the massive logical flaw that immediately raised red flags. Edgar Roe was the only operator running tours after sunset.
Ah. There it is.
There it is.
So this wasn't like a busy arbor with water taxis everywhere. This was Roe's time. This was his territory.
So his domain.
So if you got dropped off early, there was only one place to go, right back to his dock. The fact that these missing people never reappeared on shore after supposedly requesting an early drop-off,
mm-hmm.
it just completely dismantles his whole defense.
It's the linchpin. It's the thing that breaks his entire system. There was nowhere else for them to get off the boat. He controlled the harbor traffic at that specific hour. He was the sole arbiter of who left and who came back.
And this is where you see his, I guess, his overconfidence or maybe just laziness?
I think it's both. For years, the ocean had provided his cover. He just assumed this simple early drop-off excuse would work just as well as the maritime accident excuse had always worked.
He misjudged his audience.
He misjudged the mathematical rigor of the Coast Guard versus the, you know, anecdotal acceptance of the local police.
He had gotten complacent. He had successfully erased dozens of people, so he offered up an alibi that he thought would just be accepted on face value.
But the Coast Guard didn't care about his story. They cared about the physical evidence, the headcount, not the sociological explanation.
The moment they confirmed he was the only boat running at night, his story just evaporates.
Oof. Gone. The passengers vanished from the water, and they didn't return to the shore.
The anomaly signaled a consistent pattern of deliberate non-return.
And the alibi confirmed the deception. It was no longer a question of accidents. This was a scheduled event.
So with that quantitative evidence establishing the pattern, the authorities knew they had to shift gears. They had to move from observation to direct action.
This is 1932.
They couldn't just arrest him based on passenger counts alone. That was circumstantial. They needed proof of the mechanism itself. They needed the moment of intent.
They needed to catch him in the act.
So the solution they came up with was this incredibly high-stakes setup. They arranged a test ride. They booked an undercover investigator for a private trip on Roe's boat.
And this is where the story just becomes truly cinematic and, frankly, terrifying.
Absolutely.
This investigator was, I mean, he was essentially volunteering to be the next victim, mm-hmm. victim number 71, potentially. He placed himself directly into the routine, the environment that had been honed over 3 years to be completely undetectable.
The preparation for that must have been intense.
Meticulous. You have to imagine they had communication protocols, maybe a distress signal, and there had to be that explicit, unspoken understanding that he might not come back.
The tension must have been just unbearable. They needed a witness. Or they needed Roe to confirm the method by actually performing it.
And that required total isolation. They had to let Roe feel secure enough to revert back to his standard operating procedure.
The source material lays out the sequence of events with this remarkable, chilling precision.
It does.
The boat left the dock right on schedule. It's just another normal, quiet tour.
Yeah.
But then, about halfway through the trip, and this is the critical moment.
Maximum isolation.
Maximum isolation from the shore. Mm. A point where sound wouldn't carry well, where immediate intervention would be impossible. Edgar M. Roe cuts the engine.
And you have to imagine that sudden, profound silence after the constant drone of the motor. For the investigator, it must have been absolutely deafening.
It's the transition.
It's the exact instant the sightseeing cruises over and the execution platform is activated. The engine dying means they are adrift, they are alone, and they are completely powerless. They have reached the designated point of no return.
And this brings us to the quote, the chilling, terrifying quote that confirmed everything.
Mm.
Roe turned to the investigator, and not with panic or a desperate threat, but with this cold procedural finality. And he said,
"This is where it ends."
That phrase, it is just utterly profound in its succinct horror.
It's not an improvisation. It's not something he came up with on the spot.
No.
It was the verbalization of his long-established procedure. It shifts the entire tone of the story from this tense suspicion to definitive, absolute horror.
It confirms that the boat tour was never about the coast. It was never about the cool air.
It was a meticulously managed scenario, designed for one purpose: to bring a victim to the designated point of disposal. And that phrase marked the transition.
It also speaks to his, a complete lack of emotional friction in the act.
Oh, completely. He likely said that, or something very similar, 70 times over 3 years. He had streamlined his process down to that one single declarative sentence.
Which suggests the act of murder had become just the end of the service he was providing.
For him, it was just checking the final box on his ledger.
The fact that the sources preserve that specific line of dialogue is just so crucial. It's the irrefutable verbal evidence of malice. It gives us absolute clarity on his intent right before whatever confrontation happened next.
It's the moment the mask dropped completely.
And we have to assume that was the investigator's trigger. Whether it was the signal for a backup team to close in, or the moment the investigator himself had to initiate a struggle.
We know that the confrontation began immediately after that statement, and it led to the very dramatic outcome that the sources describe next.
So following Roe's chilling statement, this is where it ends. What happened next is, well, it's a bit murky. It's lost to the deep water around that struggling boat.
Right. There were no direct witnesses to the struggle itself.
But the sources do give us the stark outcome. The boat was later found drifting empty.
And neither Edgar Roe nor the undercover investigator was ever recovered. The water had taken them both, the perpetrator and the key witness.
That outcome confirms there was a struggle, a violent, immediate resolution.
It implies that either the investigator fought back fiercely to prevent his own murder, or that a prearranged backup team intervened, and in the chaos, both men went overboard.
Either way, the immediate physical evidence, that empty, drifting boat, it confirmed a violent incident had occurred.
And Roe's chosen method of disposal had finally, ironically, claimed him as well.
But if the only evidence had been the empty boat, the case might have stalled right there. It would have been circumstantial. Another unfortunate incident at sea, just this time involving an investigator.
It could have been. But months later, secondary evidence started to surface. And this became the forensic backbone of the entire case. It's what definitively confirmed Roe's method and his malice.
And that evidence was so small, personal, and heartbreaking.
It was. Weighted personal items began washing ashore.
Wallets, shoes, identification cards.
And this is the critical juncture. This is where environmental evidence finally overcomes that institutional inertia we talked about. The fact that these items were weighted is the absolute, irrefutable forensic proof of the systematic nature of Roe's operation.
It wasn't just that they fell off.
No. It implies deliberate, calculated action. Action taken by Roe after the murder to ensure the bodies and all the identifying items stayed submerged, stayed on the bottom.
Talk us through that. Why weight the bodies? I mean, isn't that more effort than just pushing them overboard?
It's more effort, but it's all about delaying and disrupting discovery. An unweighted body, especially in the warm Gulf waters, will often surface within a few days because of decomposition gases.
Okay.
If a body is found quickly by a fisherman or another boat, that immediately leads to an investigation into the cause of death. By weighting the body, Roe ensured it remained on the bottom, maximizing the time for decomposition and for currents to disperse everything. He was trying to eliminate the physical evidence of a crime.
He was trying for a perfect, untraceable erasure.
Exactly. So the discovery of these weighted artifacts, the wallets, the shoes, it serves as this profound proof that artifacts can, in fact, outlive their makers.
That's a great way to put it.
These were items designed to disappear forever, but they survived the attempt. And by washing ashore months later, they became the final irrefutable evidence against those initial police assumptions of mere accidents.
They provided the physical connection between the missing men, the location, and the confirmed method of disposal. They were speaking for the victims who couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only imagine what that was like for the investigators handling these items, these small, waterlogged artifacts of a human life. Each weighted shoe confirmed not an accident, but a premeditated, malicious murder.
Absolutely. The forensic team, likely guided by the Coast Guard's data, now had the physical proof they needed. The discovery of weighted personal effects belonging to known missing persons and, we have to presume the undercover investigator, it transformed the case.
It went from an ongoing mystery into a solved horrific pattern.
And it shifted the blame entirely, away from the chaotic, unpredictable sea and on to the meticulous, deliberate actions of Edgar M. Roe. The ocean, which had been his accomplice for 3 years, had finally started to betray his secrets.
With the physical evidence of the weighted items finally confirming the true nature of Roe's operation, the investigation officially concluded. And it confirmed the absolutely staggering scope of his deadly trade.
The final number is just horrifying.
Edgar Roe was found responsible for at least 70 disappearances.
70? That is a truly shocking figure, especially when you remember this was a localized operation. A single man, a single small boat tour business.
It speaks to his sustained ability to just evade all suspicion.
Mm.
And the sheer consistent volume of transient people passing through Galveston's port.
It also highlights the depth of that systemic failure. The failure that allowed 70 murders to be filed away under miscellaneous accidents.
And we have to stress the nuance here, which the sources are very clear about. They state that the true number was never confirmed.
Right. 70 is the floor, not the ceiling.
It's exactly. 70 is the number the investigation could reasonably link to Roe's established pattern before he died. That qualification is so vital because it acknowledges that those 3 years of unchecked activity likely resulted in an even higher and perhaps unknowable toll.
The ocean kept many of his secrets, even after he was gone.
To execute 70 murders without a single forensic error, just relying on institutional inertia, it's a chilling testament to his effectiveness as a serial killer.
And that scale, it demanded an immediate and decisive response from the authorities. Not just to close the investigation, but to restore public trust in the safety of their own harbor.
So what do they do?
The sources detail these twin final actions that were taken to officially close the book on the Midnight Mariner. And these actions, they serve as a profound sociological statement.
Okay.
First, Roe's boat was sunk deliberately. And second, all night tours in Galveston were permanently banned.
Sinking the boat. That is such a powerful symbolic act. The deliberate destruction of the murder weapon.
They didn't sell it or scrap it. They condemned it and removed it completely from public view.
It's more than symbolic, though, isn't it? It feels like an act of institutional and societal erasure.
That's the perfect word for it. When a community is faced with a localized horror that exposes its own systemic failure, the government often tries to remove both the means and the memory of the tragedy.
Sinking the boat and banning the activity.
They were aggressive acts, designed to remove the tool and the reminder of the terrible secret the town had been harboring for 3 years.
It's a form of cultural memory management. Sinking the boat basically declared that specific mechanism of murder permanently inactive. It was the tangible, physical act of closing the door on that nightmare.
And the permanent legal ban on night tours is probably the more enduring legacy. The law itself became the memorial.
It was an aggressive overcorrection.
It was. The system had failed at first by accepting the cover story of accidents, but its final action was to prohibit the entire activity forever, just to prevent any possible resurgence of the pattern, even by a copycat.
So every time someone after 1932 inquired about a night tour in Galveston, the answer, no, those are permanently banned, it would implicitly carry the silent heavyweight of Edgar M. Roe.
And the 70-plus missing souls.
It was an official acknowledgement that the environment itself couldn't be trusted after dark, because a human predator had proven he could exploit its shadows so perfectly.
The story of the Midnight Mariner is just a horrifying example of how simplicity, consistency, and a profound understanding of bureaucratic blind spots can create the perfect cover for profound evil.
He exploited trust, anonymity, and the vastness of the ocean.
All disguised by the innocent promise of cool air and a short, quiet ride.
And that brings us to the end of this deep dive into the tragic and, I think, truly compelling story of Edgar M. Roe, the Midnight Mariner of Galveston.
Mm.
We've traced the quiet, unremarkable start of his business in 1928, the escalating tide of disappearances between 1929 and 1931.
The methodical detection by the Coast Guard's simple accounting.
Right. And then the sudden fatal conclusion of that undercover operation in 1932. What stands out most to me is how a seemingly benign, short transaction, a casual night tour, could be so perfectly engineered for such a sinister purpose.
Right.
The failure wasn't a lack of drama. It was a failure to believe that something so outwardly mundane could have such immense, cold-blooded horror.
And it reminds us that consistency in the small details is often the greatest cover.
It forces you to go back and reframe those initial marketing points.
Quiet water, cool air, short rides.
We first saw them as amenities, as reasons to take the trip. But after charting all the evidence, you realize
they were the design specifications of the trap. The quiet tour was never about a relaxing escape from the city.
The quiet water ensured the scene was undisturbed.
The short ride ensured the victim felt secure enough to board without any suspicion.
And the cool air masked the chilling reality that the journey had only one predefined end.
It just proves that sometimes the quietest journey is simply the sound of the world deciding where it ends for you.
We hope this exploration of the sources gives you a deeper, more chilling understanding of this historical tragedy. It's a powerful reminder that the greatest threats often hide not in the darkest alleys, but in the most ordinary of settings. We will see you on the next deep dive.